This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Did you watch the foreign policy debate last night? Yeah, me too. I thought it was interesting how they both kept bringing it back to the domestic economy, though, huh? Oh, and about that economy, there's something you need to know. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts designed with convenient features to help reach savings goals. To learn more or open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Tuesday, the 23rd of October. Good as always to have you with us. And we begin today with a caveat. It's not a new one, but it bears repeating from time to time. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is not the economy, and the economy is not the Dow. We've said that before, but one can learn things about what's going on in the actual economy by watching the Dow. And if you were watching today, not a pretty picture at all. The Dow lost 240-some-odd points, mostly because Wall Street seems to think corporate earnings are coming in a bit too soft. We could, if we wanted to, trot out the usual suspects right here, the bellwether companies, to show you what we mean. GE, Intel, you know the names. But come on, boring, right? Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon dug a little bit deeper into the stock charts.
Illinois Tool Works might not be a household name, but it operates more than 800 different businesses, everything from welding and commercial kitchen equipment to car care products. Investor Relations Chief John Brooklier says its profit picture this quarter was also diverse.
Europe and Asia Pacific continue to be a little weaker, and they've been persistently weaker. North America, U.S.-led, continues to be a number that's, you know, reliably in sort of a 3 to 4% growth rate.
And so, despite slowing international demand, the industrial conglomerate still saw its overall profits rise almost 3.5%. Economist Joel Naroff says that's the give and take that U.S. companies and American workers are coping with right now.
It's an interesting thing. The U.S. economy may be getting better. We may be selling more here, but that doesn't necessarily turn into more jobs in the U.S. because if the rest of the world is having problems, something has to give, and some of that is U.S. employment.
Illinois Tool Works may be benefiting, in fact, because its customers are under pressure to protect their profits. Acting CEO Scott Santee says companies are spending more on equipment, not jobs.
I think it is indicative of the fact that our customer base are still looking to make investments in new products and new capabilities that help drive better productivity, better performance for them.
Economist Joel Naroff says the U.S. economy may be growing for now, but the slowdown abroad threatens to throttle that back.
There's no way that firms are going to be able to hire under those circumstances.
And it might get worse. DuPont today joined several other big companies in announcing a new round of job cuts. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Here's a bellwether company you might have heard a little bit about. Apple, maker of iMacs and iPods, and as of today, more iPads than you can shake a stick at. They rolled out the new iPad mini this morning. 7.9-inch screen, pencil thin, $329 if you're interested. There are, allowing for different sizes and configurations, 14 different iPads on the market now. And you thought potato chips came in a lot of varieties. Marketplace's Queen of Kim has more on that.
The big news today was supposed to be about the iPad mini, but it was almost upstaged by the new, faster iPad 4. The surprise announcement left some techies who bought the iPad 3 6 months ago a little upset. Sarah Rotman Epps is an analyst at Forrester, and she says at least the iPad 4 looks the same.
So there isn't that status marker of, oh, my iPad is thinner than yours.
And now to the mini. Roger Kay is a tech analyst in New York.
Apple is coming out with a product that I think of as being defensive. There are other competitors, notably Samsung with its Galaxy and Amazon with Fire, in that space already.
And Kay says the competition is taking some market share from the iPad. The iPad mini has a bigger screen than its competitors, but at $329, it's $100 more than the Galaxy and nearly $200 more than the 7-inch Kindle. And that's left some people wondering, who is Apple competing with? Other tablets or itself? Epp says consumers have shown they're willing to pay more for Apple products. And so while it's relatively expensive, the mini is still competitive. At the same time, Epps expects the mini to eat into full-size tablet sales. But she says that's not a bad thing.
Apple deserves a lot of credit for being willing to cannibalize its own product before someone else does.
It's this willingness to compete against itself that has, in part, made Apple a success. I'm Queen of Kim for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today? Yeah, no, forget about it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've got a collaboration going with Frontline on PBS this month. It's a special investigation into campaign finance, specifically what the Supreme Court's ruling in a case called Citizens United a couple of years ago, which said labor unions and corporations can spend essentially as much as they want on politics, how that has changed our campaigns. This election cycle, as you know, is being driven by more money than ever, but also by more data than ever. Hari Srinivasan from PBS NewsHour explains how campaigns are using that data to influence what shows up on your computer screen and at your doorstep.
Before the debates, before the rallies and the speeches and the millions of dollars in political ads, the hunt for voters begins at places like this. Aristotle, Inc., one of the most powerful political data mining firms in the country.
We've got 2-inch steel doors, security cameras, a biometric sensor. I'm just going to try the doorbell.
Democrats and Republicans have been buying voter data from Aristotle since Ronald Reagan ran for president. And this election, they're buying more than ever. John Phillips is the CEO. He says elections are like one-day sales.
You got to get all the shoppers to the store on one day. And it's hard to argue that balloons and emery boards are a particularly effective way of persuading people to vote.
What's effective, Phillips says, is when a candidate can make every political message feel like a personal conversation. And to do that, you need to know as much about the person you're talking to as possible. What makes this election different is that campaigns know more about us than ever, and more than you'd probably want them to.
So show me how the targeting works.
Sure. So you have the ability to target in on a variety of different criteria.
Phillips says there are up to 500 data points candidates can analyze and plug into algorithms. He says to think of it as the DNA of the electorate. Everything from the standard
ethnicity, what the census says,
to the not-so-standard
big game hunter, a turkey hunter. I don't know if turkey hunters are different from big game hunters, but I suspect they are.
Right.
The goal for both campaigns is to use that data to reveal something about what drives us to vote one way or another.
You may not vote Republican because you drive a Corvette, but there may be a correlation between people who own Corvettes and voting behavior. And if there is, then they're going to be trying to find as many Corvette owners as they can if it turns out that that's a profile of somebody who's an independent voter in Ohio.
Ohio, as you probably know by now, is a key battleground state. I went to Columbus to one of Obama's field offices where a group of Ohio State University students were getting ready to knock on doors and do some old-fashioned political canvassing.
And we have to end with fired up!
Ready to go!
Fired up!
Ready to go!
But along with pens and clipboards, these students were also armed with some of the most sophisticated digital tools out there. For the 2012 Obama campaign, it's called Dashboard.
These flags are the voters. These are the doors that you could potentially knock.
Ashley Bryant is Obama's digital director for Ohio. She's showing me how the students can use Dashboard today. When these OSU canvassers knock on doors, they don't just know who they'll be talking to.
You know, hi is blank available and you see their name at the top.
But they'll have a customized message based on all the big data information the Obama campaign has gathered. Did they donate to Obama last year? Do they vote in every election? Did this person work at one of Ohio's revitalized manufacturing plants?
So if I'm an undecided voter and the more you know about me, the more tailored that pitch is going to be to me?
Absolutely.
Isn't that a little weird?
Well, it's not going to, we're not going to say, hey, we saw you at the movies last night.
But if you tell a canvasser you were at the movies last night, say a political documentary, that bit of information could be headed straight into the Obama campaign's giant data pool in Chicago, along with anything else you may reveal.
It's all going into one big system. And then, you know, once that information is there, it's able to be, you know, researched and analyzed and figure out, you know, what are the buckets.
Bucket is a term both campaigns use to categorize different kinds of voters. Are you a supporter who will donate money? That puts you in one bucket. Are you voting for the other guy? That's a different bucket. But the most valuable bucket of all, as you figured out by now, is the one filled with undecided voters. They could be the key to this election for the campaign that can find them. The question is how.
For the Romney campaign, what we have determined that if we only rely on national television, we will lose this election.
That's Zach Moffitt, Romney's national digital director. Moffitt says the heart of the campaign's digital strategy is to reach voters he calls off the gritters, people who can't be reached by traditional campaign methods.
You know, they don't think of Modern Family as starting at 8 o'clock on Wednesday. They think of it as starting when they turn on their DVR box. And they don't think of Modern Family as 30 minutes. They think of it as 22 minutes with 8 minutes of fast-forwarding.
Which means they're missing a lot of expensive political ads. Moffitt says as many as a third of the electorate fits this category. Obama does this in-house. Romney outsources to a private interactive ad agency Moffitt helped co-found. It's called Targeted Victory.
So this week, you know, just go over a little bit of the social media numbers in the presidential campaign.
That's Michael Beach, Targeted Victory's co-founder. He says data allows them to pinpoint the most effective ad for a voter to see.
Think of it less that we're buying a channel, that we're buying an audience. And so we're not necessarily concerned with where the ad runs, is who it runs to. And that's kind of flips the whole mass marketing traditional on its head.
So if Targeted Victory figures out that I'm an off-the-gritter who supports Romney, I may see this ad.
Who shares your values?
But if I'm an independent, I might see something like this.
What will be different about a Romney presidency?
But unlike TV, watching this ad online and then maybe sharing it on Facebook or Twitter gives both campaigns valuable information about voters, which they can then store and use later.
You know, how you engage with an ad or how long you watch an ad or anything like that is feedback that tells, you know, the campaign, hey, you know, this is, you know, this is the right message or this is not the right message. And so, you know, that could change what a campaign decided to deliver in the future.
Because while the 2012 presidential election ends next week, there's always 2016 to think about. In Washington, D.C., I'm Hari Srinivasan for Marketplace.
Want to find out how digital campaigns are targeting you? There's an interactive quiz you can take at marketplace.org. Coming up next week, a radio story about the campaign trail, tracking candidates 24/7. Our partnership with Frontline, by the way, comes to a head next Tuesday night, a television documentary I did called Big Sky, Big Money, about some of the secrets of political money this election season. Mark your calendars, October the 30th. Check your local listings, as they say. Coming up.
That's the power of Google data. People tend to be a lot more honest, the search engine.
Why would we lie? Political truth from a search engine. But first, let's do the numbers. Ooh, the wah-wah trombones. Haven't heard those in a while. The Dow Industrials lost 243 points, 1.8%, finished at 13,102. Honestly, I never know what the music's going to be. NASDAQ gave back 26 points, almost 0.9%, 2990. The number of the S&P 500 decreased by 20 points, 1.4%, 1413 the number. DuPont posted earnings, as Bob was saying, that missed analyst expectations. Shares declined by 9%. United Parcel Service also reported lower profits, but the world's biggest package delivery company raised its outlook for 2012. Stock there ticked up 3%. Apple sliced off 3%. Today, iPad mini, be damned. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year Treasury fell to 1.76%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
This podcast is supported by American Express Bank, FSB, offering high-yield savings accounts with a competitive variable interest rate and convenient access via phone or web. Link your existing bank accounts without switching banks. To learn how this FDIC-insured high-yield savings account can complement your savings goals and to open an account online, visit personalsavings.com/savings. Member FDIC.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, a look at the health of the housing market. The Commerce Department reports on sales of new homes for September. President Obama is scheduled to make an appearance on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. And here's something for your gams. On October 24, 1939, in Wilmington, Delaware, nylon stockings went on sale to the public for the first time. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Obama's coming to L.A. tomorrow. It's going to be a quickie. I think he's on the ground for an hour and a half or something. He's popping in transcontinentally to do The Tonight Show, some combination of campaigning and politicking, I guess. Same thing today in Washington. The Obama campaign launched a huge media push targeted mostly at swing states, spelling out the president's plans for the next 4 years, should he get another 4 years. Part of it is a full-color 20-page booklet they're going to be handing out to people, actually handing out, because what? They've never heard of the internet? Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein has that story.
This ad campaign is big. Radio spots, direct mailers, TV commercials.
There's just no quit in America. And you're seeing that right now.
And then there's the booklet, all 3.5 million copies of it. A typical publishing run is normally in the hundreds of thousands. Is this overkill? Sasha Strauss is a marketing expert with Innovation Protocol. He says, think of the booklet like the free keychains you'd get at a convention. Even if it never gets read, the booklet serves as a physical reminder for people.
They want something that feels more than just digital letters being sent out through the digital universe to digital recipients on their mobile phones while they're on subways.
Strauss says just putting a campaign message online in this super saturated media landscape is too easily lost. The Obama campaign would not say how much the booklets cost, but it's planning to distribute them mostly in swing states between now and the election. Strauss says 4 years ago, the Obama campaign was known for its use of the internet. Now, it's showing it's got range.
This is saying, well, you've had the last 5 years, Republican Party, to catch up to us in social media, and you're doing a little better now. We're going to do a 180. We're going to show you that even if we use classic methods of communication, we can still effectively tell people what we believe in.
Marissa Gluck is a media consultant at Radar Research. She says any successful ad campaign has to do a little bit of everything.
No product, whether we're talking about a politician or soap, only advertises in one medium.
If you do, Gluck warns that a company or a candidate risks missing out on potential buyers. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
With apologies to the president, the 1980s called. They want their steel jobs back. And you know what? They're coming back. In Ohio in particular, manufacturing jobs are up. Unemployment is down. How come? There's all kinds of oil and gas drilling going on out there. And when you drill, you need pipe, steel pipe. And we are drilling more than ever in this country. There's something of a boom in domestic energy production happening. So we're working on an occasional series about America being possibly the next petrostate. Here's Marketplace's Scott Tong from the Sustainability Desk today out in Canton, Ohio.
Nixon goes to China. Pigs fly. Steel jobs return to eastern Ohio. Yaha. For those of us who've not paid attention, $1 billion is being invested in mills in Youngstown, Lorain, and here in Canton. At the Timken Steel Company, Vice President Tom Moline looks proudly upon a big hole in the ground.
It will be the largest jumbo bloom caster in the world.
Translation?
This machine is going to be a monster. It will be the tallest structure in Stark County when it's done. And I believe the depth of this pit is close to the average depth of Lake Erie.
Timken is adding a gee-whiz steel plant, in large part because oil and gas companies need pipes for drilling. In the Gulf, in North Dakota, in Texas, right here under the Buckeye trees.
There are stabilizer bars, there are toe joints, there are drill collars, there's heavy wall drill pipe, and there's actually the drill bit itself. Our steel participates in all those applications.
Inside the mill, they dump tons of scrap metal, old fridges, junked cars, into a 3,000-degree furnace. They melt the steel, they stir it, add and subtract stuff. Alloys are good, hydrogen's bad. Then they pour it, cool it, stretch it, cut off the ends, and out come highly pure, highly engineered metal tubes. And the oil men are buying. Here's energy analyst Ed Morse at Citigroup.
The Rust Belt places are undergoing the very beginnings of a massive renaissance of industrial development.
Morse paints a cheery forecast for domestic oil and gas production that it could create a million jobs in manufacturing. Maybe. Whatever the number, he argues that big American factories win, not just by selling to oil and gas companies, but also buying cheap energy from them.
If you have low-cost available energy, you can be a very efficient steel producer. The traditional energy-intensive industries, where the U.S. had lost its competitive edge, it now has regained it.
Just up Sheppler Church Avenue is steel supplier Solmet Technologies. It's having its best year yet. And Vice President Matt Halter credits oil and gas. To him, a key leading indicator is the Canton White Truck Index.
These companies around here that are drilling, that's how they get around. And when you start seeing your roads full of white pickup trucks, it means good things are coming.
Those white truck guys, they pay an awful lot of money for a fancy piece of steel.
You could have a $400 motor up to a $25,000 piece.
It's a new chapter in an old story of Eastern Ohio and steel. Canton's heyday goes back to railroad days and making tracks, says historian Jackie Stuckey Welling at Malone University. Back then, she says,
we're the early Chicago in frontier America. With the boom in the production of iron and steel, we're located near coal fields. We're located near transportation routes.
Similar story with nearby Youngstown. So when World War II came around, the Department of War Information spun out a patriotic documentary hailing the Ohio Steel Mill.
This is the ore. It looks like dirt, but in a few weeks it'll become part of a ship, a tank, or a gun.
In reality, Ohio Steel was declining. The economic action moved west to the actual Chicago. Technology replaced workers. Tens of thousands here lost jobs. On September 19, 1977, Youngstown Sheet and Tube closed down. They call it Black Monday. Here's laid-off mill worker James Davis in an archived interview years later.
There'll be a time when 10% of the workforce will produce all the goods and services that are needed for the entire country. And the question becomes, what do you do with the other 90%?
Today, Eastern Ohio is known dubiously as a place people have left. John D. Rockefeller, the Hoover Vacuum Company. And don't get people started here on the old Cleveland Browns or LeBron James.
Of course it's happening in Northeast Ohio.
Again, historian Jackie Welling.
The river catches on fire in, you know, the late 1960s. In Cleveland, I think, if I remember correctly, the mayor's toupee catches on fire. It just seems like, okay, what else is going to happen?
And now, steel jobs are happening. Now, for Ohioans conditioned to look for the catch, Ohio State economist Mark Partridge offers this. Not all those lost jobs will be back.
We look at a steel mill of, say, a couple generations ago. They employed thousands and thousands of people. Today, steel mills might just employ hundreds of people. So it isn't going to just completely turn around the Midwest.
Competitive companies today employ lots of machines, not so many people. But Canton will take it, the proverbial shot in the arm for an economy long punched in the face. We save the last word for Timken steel worker Jim Davidson.
We come from good stock. We go to work every day. You know, if people get famous and leave, that's not our lot in life. I mean, we're lunchbox toters. We go to work every day and grind out a living.
In Canton, Ohio, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
What makes all that drilling possible, as you might have already heard, is a technology called hydraulic fracturing, fracking. For short. You can see exactly how fracking works in the animated video we've got on our website. It's called, I love this, One Frackin' Minute. Marketplace.org is the website. There are dozens of polls out there all trying to do essentially the same thing. Predict what's going to happen 2 weeks from today. Who's going to win, in what states, by how much? They do that by asking, getting people to answer questions. But people lie. They're not always straight with pollsters. You know who they are straight with? Google, which is how we know that even more than Paul Ryan's budget, people want to know what Paul Ryan looks like without his shirt on. Seth Stevens Davidowitz studies economics at Harvard. He also studies data from Google to figure out what voters really want. Seth, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
When you go and dig into your Google data sets, what do you learn? I mean, what's out there for us to find out about us as a voting populace?
Yes, that's the power of Google data. People tend to be a lot more honest with a search engine. It has this amazing ability to kind of get people to say what they're really thinking and feeling. It's really a reality check. You know, when you see focus groups and you think people were, you know, sitting in their computers with spreadsheets open waiting to fill in all the numbers if the candidates just gave it to them. And, you know, really they're looking for more more Paul Ryan photo shoots.
All right. Well, I have to do this on the studio computer now. We're, what, 2 weeks away from Election Day, right?
Yeah.
So I'm going to go Paul Ryan. Let's see. First of all, I got to spell it right. Look at that. It's Paul Ryan shirtless is literally the first thing that comes up. Yeah. And then marathon and then budget is the third item.
Yeah.
So if I type in Paul Ryan shirtless, do I have to worry that Google's going to know who I am?
Oh, no, no. That's very important. This is anonymous aggregate data. Any other person on the planet has no idea who's making any searches. So please, if anything, you should feel proud when you're making your embarrassing searches that you're helping science.
That's right. That's right. It's all in a good cause. How granular can this location data get for Google? I mean, if I'm sitting in, you know, Ottumwa, Iowa, is Google going to show, you know, turnout queries are high in Ottumwa?
Right now, I'm using media markets. There are hundreds of media markets in the United States. But even at using the media market level data, you can get a pretty good sense, I think, of turnout by demographics. So in the 2008 election, it was very clear in this data that African-American turnout was not surprisingly going to skyrocket in 2008. They were the areas that saw by far the biggest increases in searches for how to vote, where to vote, etc.
What's the big takeaway then from your data this year? I mean, close in the polls, shed some light.
I think there's great demand for more photo shoots from Paul Ryan 2 weeks out of the election. That's might be the big takeaway. No, the big takeaway I would say is that the 2012 electorate turnout-wise is looking more like the 2008 electorate, which on balance is a good sign for Barack Obama. Of course, turnout's only part of the issue. He still has to get support among the swing voters, and that is certainly very, very much in doubt.
Seth Stevens-Davidovits is a PhD student in economics at Harvard University. His piece in the New York Times about Google and what it can tell us about the electorate this time around. It's called Google's Crystal Ball. Seth, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today, one last follow-up to the debate last night and this.
Well, Governor, we also have fewer horses and bayonets because the nature of our military has changed.
Which is true for military horses especially. They're mostly all ceremonial now. But bayonets, the Marine Corps still uses them. In fact, the Corps spent $4.3 million back in 2003 to buy every Marine his or her own bayonet. It's more like a knife, really, a 13-inch long, really scary-looking knife. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM this Tuesday. Thanks to Sean Bowditch, Mary Dew, and Justin Ho on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.